You're listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show, making the world a better place, one show at a time. You're listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show, making this world a better place one show at a time. At least we're trying.
The hardest working man in internet radio is my father, George Wilder Jr.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thanks for tuning into the show, folks. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you decided to tune in and listen to the George Wilder Jr. Show right here on Blog Talk Radio, WTTTY. It is 6 o'clock straight up in Chicago. It is a beautiful day. Once again, like I was just losing my breath yesterday talking about how nice it is in the city of Chicago and wishing everybody around the world, hoping that they're in good spirits and that the weather in their neck of the woods is also shining on them. All right, let's move right along. They're saying now that actually all good things have to come to an end. Obviously, the great weather that we've been having here so far would end up with tornadoes. That's something, huh? I don't know. You know, I take everything I hear on the news and the weather forecast with a grain of salt. But it's nothing wrong with preparing in case they're right. But we'll just have to wait and see if that's going to happen. It could. But however, you know, it's been so beautiful so far in the city of Chicago in this neck of the woods. It's hard to believe that just in a few hours there's going to be tornadoes. But, you know, who knows? I'm not an expert on this thing, but I have been the weather department. They have been known to be wrong, you know, or I may be wrong. We'll just have to wait and see. All right. My guest today is author Maxwell Ivey. We're going to be talking about some politics and anything and everything that you might want to hear or talk about on this show. 347-857-1762 is the number. And we're going to be talking about things in Chicago. There's a threat of schools not opening. I think there's one or two more days left for Chicago public schools, and then the summer vacation begins. And a lot of parents are up in arms because they feel that there's no school funding, so there may not be any school opening in the fall. Bruce Rauner is crisscrossing the Illinois, blaming someone else for the things that he has caused. That's obvious. And and this, I just have to talk about this one, folks. This guy, Bruce Rauner, there's a litany of things that he has done to destroy the state of Illinois. I mean, there is nothing that if you can think of any social program within the realms of Illinois, he has cut it, decimated it, or just outright eliminated the program. I mean, it could, anything you can name, he has done it. This is the second cycle in Illinois without a budget. This has never happened before. This is unprecedented. This has never happened before. Illinois has never been without a budget. once, but twice? Twice? And he's crisscrossing around the state, acting as if he's the victim in all of this. Like he's the one that's being trampled on when he is trampling on the state of Illinois. Anybody in their right mind will not believe that. The man act like he's the one that's that we're the ones that are at fault and he's innocent. Give me a break. If he had not have been elected, this would not be in the state of Illinois. This has never happened in this state. Rauner, his intentions in the first was to dismantle this state, to tear it apart, to rip it apart at the seams, and then blame someone else for it, and hoping that the people, the voters of Illinois, will heed his side of the story, throw out all the Democrats, and put in his Republicans, his hand-picked and bought-off Republicans. And this is crazy. This is not going to happen. I've said so many times before that the reason why Rauner and so many other Republicans around America are in office today is because people voted against their own interest or people did not vote. This is how we get these rogue Republicans in office. People, they just refuse to vote. And then, you know, when the Republicans are destroying their state, destroying their way of life, you know, well, I should have voted. Well, it's too late. It's too late, or I shouldn't have voted for him because there's so many people in the state of Illinois that's been being affected by Rauner and his BS. People all over the state has been saying that they wish they had not voted for him or they wish they had voted. Well, now hopefully they will do so in November if there is a state left, because this guy, he is adamant on breaking up this state. He has cut a lot of social programs that are decimated to the south and west sides of the city, and he wants to visit over there and talk. They don't want him over there. I don't blame him. Why should he come over there when he has made those people's lives more miserable than what they already were? I don't blame him. You know, they said, get the hell away from over here. And these are actual quotes. You know, so, but the kicker is, folks, that this guy who has decimated Illinois, who has destroyed Illinois, who has continued to do these things, go around the state, talk about Chicago public schools, not fund them. They may be not opening in the fall. He claims that he cares so much about the schools opening in fall. He's the one who's trying to keep the state from falling off the cliff when he is the one who is kicking it off the cliff. I hope people don't fall for his lies, his spin, his way of trying to win seats in November so he can take over the state of Illinois. That's all it is. Because if Rauner and his Republicans lose seats if they lose seats in November, this coming November, it's over. It's over. It doesn't matter. I mean, because the legislature will be able to override anything that he vetoes. Rauner has a numerous amount of spending bills on his desk, but he will not sign them. He will lie and spin, talk over it, talk around it, make it seem like he's the victim in all of this when all he has to do is sign bills. But one of the things I do know, if Rauner signed a budget today, a lot of the programs that he has decimated, they're gone for good, or it will take some time for those programs to regenerate themselves to be the kinds of social programs that they were before he destroyed them. Will never ever be the same in Illinois. You know, I mean, they will not be the same. These programs are gone. The jobs are gone. Employment, unemployment under Rauner has risen. And yet he doesn't want to answer any questions on these, on this issue. If he answered questions, he's going to quickly pivot and turn it around and put it on Michael Madigan and John Culloden, two people who sometimes I feel takes some of the blame, but since Rauner is the governor and he deliberately not signed these bills, okay, he's saying that he has a stopgap budget. That's ludicrous. I do not agree with a stopgap budget. A stopgap budget is just a half a year budget. It's like a part-time budget. He's two cycles behind. He needs to sign two budgets, and yet he just want to sign a budget for 6 months. And then after five or six months, we're back in the same mess we're in. I don't go for that. I would rather see an entire yearly budget signed for the fiscal year. That's me. Why sign a half-ass budget when you can do a whole one? So the General Assembly is not in. Nobody's voting on anything. Nobody's talking about anything. The only person that's talking is probably Rauner. And the only time Michael Madigan or Culloden comes out and talk, when Rauner says something on television or in the newspapers, something that they don't agree with, then they come out with a rebuttal. But that's it. There's nothing being worked on. There's nothing being talked about. There's no votes, nothing going on in the General Assembly to try to get us out of this mess, to try to get the state of Illinois out of this mess. It is a mess, folks, in the state of Illinois, and it's just getting messier. And I do think that the federal government should intervene in this. These guys they don't know what the hell they're doing. They're letting the state rot. This is political. This is totally political. Governor Rauner is a guy you can't trust. Governor Rauner is someone they don't trust. That's one of the reasons why they don't want to work with this guy, because they don't trust him. And they are not going to let this guy up in the middle class. He wants to bust unions. He wants unions so bad he can taste it. He's even turned against Rahm Emanuel. If you're going to blast somebody out, if you're going to talk about somebody, you don't do it in the media. You don't do it in the press. You take them to a back room or somewhere and just have a nice conversation between yourselves. You don't blast nobody out or attack someone that's supposed to be your friend and all that kind of. Rauner, he does it to Rahm Emanuel. He does it to Madigan. Rauner doesn't give a damn. He wants power. He wants the power that Madigan has. He wants the power that Culloden has. He wants the power that union has. Don't even think about a minimum wage. Rauner actually wants to eliminate it. A lot of people want it raised. That ain't going to happen with Rauner. It's not even talked about. Some other states it's talked about. But with Rauner, it's not talked about. And a lot of these Republican governors around the state have destroyed their states. Rauner have destroyed this one, have destroyed Illinois. For instance, Sam Brownback destroyed Kansas. Christie, New Jersey. Chris Christie, New Jersey. John Kasich, Ohio. Who else is there? Scott Walker of Wisconsin. Lousy, lousy Republican governors who got in the office because people did not vote or people voted against their own interest. And like I said before, a lot of these folks are just, they are pissed off that they didn't vote. Maybe next time they will participate in democracy and vote. That's all you have is your vote. You're not helpless, folks. You're not helpless against these rogue politicians. You are not helpless. You have your vote. Get out there and use it so your vote will interest you and be the interest of the people of that state. Vote your interest. Vote your conscience. But vote the right way. All right, you're listening to the George Wanda Jr. Show on Black Talk Radio. Folks, I'm just like every other show. I'm always, you know, I'm always ranting and rant. It's just that I'm passionate about Illinois. I'm passionate about Chicago, and I hate to see it destroyed by a couple of knucklehead politicians who claim that they're out there, they're doing this for you and me, and it's for our benefit. No, destroying Illinois is not in the benefit of the people of the state. You know, Rauner has been in, he's been in office for almost 2 years, and he's talking about becoming reelected. Give me a break. The way you've destroyed the state, do you actually think people going to vote for you? All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Block Talk Radio. I'm a little passionate here, folks. I hope you understand that. All right, let's go to the phones. Okay, you are on the George Wilder Jr. Show. Go right ahead.
Hello, George. This is Maxwell Ivey.
How you doing, Maxwell?
I think I'm supposed to be calling in now, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, you're fine, man. Believe me, you're fine. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Maxwell Ivey on the George Wilder Jr. Show. He's a 49-year-old blind gentleman who grew up in a family of carnival owners. And all he ever wanted was to continue in his father's and grandfather's footsteps to be a part of a family business. Maxwell, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, George. I'm really appreciate you having me on here, and hope you're having a good evening.
Oh yeah, man, I'm having a great time. It's I'm in my studio here, and I'm looking out on the boulevard, and the weather is just great. They're saying we're going to get tornadoes later. You know, it doesn't look like it to me, but it could happen.
Well, summer has finally come to Houston, Texas. We've had a week of 90 plus temperatures and 70 plus humidity, which means that if you use the heat index calculator, that's anywhere from 105 to 1010 or higher. So as a city, we're pretty much shut down and everybody's trying to hide from the heat.
Yeah, from the heat. I was hearing that you guys had a lot of flooding back sometime back.
Yeah, we had flooding in April for tax day. We had flooding in May for Memorial Day. And the people that got flooded are very happy to see all this sunshine. But the problem is there's so much humidity in the air that even when it's sunny most of the time, you still have these what they call pop-up showers that come from the atmosphere being heated up and generating rain. So it just doesn't seem like them poor people can get away from it. And, you know, no sooner than the rain water stopped falling, they also had to deal with all the rain in the river system from up north of here in Dallas and Fort Worth and even as far as Kansas and Missouri, where all that rain has to filter through the river system and eventually go to the Gulf of Mexico, which is right there on our doorstep. So,
Wow. Well, anyway, today is a pretty nice day, and we have to be thankful for that. All right, Maxwell, tell the people, I said I gave you an introduction, but you can tell the people a little bit more about yourself and what you do.
Well, I grew up in a carnival business. When that business failed due to the early death of my father, I started an online business to help people broker amusement equipment. So when I knew I wasn't going to be able to travel anymore, I figured, well, what do I know? And at that point, I really didn't think I knew much. I figured since I had helped the family sell rides when we had to occasionally do that, I figured, well, I could do that as a profession now. And sure enough, it turned out that I could. Of course, I had to, you know, learn a whole lot of new skills about having a website, being in business for myself as opposed to taking over somebody else's run. I was blogging. I was on social media. I was recording videos, and people started, you know, telling me how inspiring it was to see what I was doing, and they encouraged me to start a website, a second site where I share the more personal aspects of being a blind entrepreneur. It's called theblindblogger.net. And I originally didn't see myself as an inspiration or somebody who motivated other people, but they say mainly it's just the fact that I continue to show up and figure out a way to get to the next step in my journey. And as a result, I'm now a coach, a speaker, twice self-published author. If I could find me a partner to record with, I want to record an album, you know, all these things that I would have never thought of in a million years, maybe a billion years, you know, let's say 2.5 years ago, something I would have never thought of would happen has happened.
Yeah.
But it happened because the one thing was gone. I accepted that it was gone, and I started with, well, what can I do about it now? And that just, you know, when you open your eyes to one new possibility and you take advantage of it, you embrace it, you know, you grab onto it with both hands, as they say, you start noticing more things that are inside you, opportunities, and more friends come along for the ride.
You do. That's true, because once you find out you have a talent for something, you find out you have a talent for a lot more things also. And then you become like a jack of all trades. Because, you know, I mean, if you have a talent, you know, it branches out. And people love to be around other people with talent. They love to kind of hang on with people with talent. And so that's great. That's wonderful that you're finding more things about yourself, about your life that you want to try to do to help people. All right. What motivates you to want to help others?
You know, I don't really know where it comes from. I know it's something I've had in me most of my life in one form or another. But it just seems like I get as much joy from helping somebody else do it as I do from doing it for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of times I set out to do something to solve a problem, and I share that with people, and it's like, well, and now that you've done it, I'm not as scared to do it myself kind of thing. So, I mean, when I wrote a post a couple years ago about using Pinterest, and Pinterest is a visual website where people share pictures,
mm-hmm.
and now they should share video on there. And I figured out a way to use it. Now, I can't see the other people's pictures, but I can read their captions and the text that they post along with their pictures. But I can post my pictures and post my descriptions and links to my website, and it gives me a place where there are a lot of people participating out there. And when I wrote that post, I figured, well, other blind people will go, man, I should be on Pinterest, and it's not that bad. But I got lots of posts from sighted people who said that their friends or business associates had been telling them that they needed to be on Pinterest, and they just hadn't tried it because they were scared or because they weren't sure it was something they could use. They said after they read my post, it really solved the block, and a lot of those people started using something that, you know, is a good tool for people's businesses. So I just get a lot of satisfaction in helping other people make progress.
Yeah. Maxwell, does your blindness is that a plus or a negative for what you do?
You know, I think it's a plus for what I do. I think would people still be interested in what I'm doing if I was sighted? I think they would, because there are a lot of people out there who need help figuring out how to run their blog or social media or things like that. So I think that I would still have an audience, but I do admit that a lot of doors probably open up quicker and wider for me because of the blindness. And, you know, there is a bit of magnification. A lot of people who are sighted will say about or think about what I do as being more impressive than it is. You know, the best example I can think of that is, you know, most people, if they know a blind person, they may have one person in their circle that's blind or visually impaired. So that person becomes the blind friend. I became the blind blogger because I was the only blogger in a bunch of social media groups where I was actively out there blogging and open that I was blind while I was doing it. This was before the blindblogger.net. This was when I was focusing strictly on MidwayMarketplace.com, my brokering site. But since I was the only one they knew, people started referring to me as the blind blogger. Just, you know, it's the natural for people to want to come up with shorthand and nicknames.
Yeah.
And so when I wanted to start my site, they said, Max, we've been calling you the blind blogger for a year now. Why not see if it's available? And that's how I ended up being the blind blogger. And woman last week now, she said she's now known internationally as the blind blogger. And I was like, well, that's cool. I didn't know that happened, but thank you. But what I like to point out to people is there are a lot of blind people out here who are bloggers,
yeah,
podcasters,
there
authors,
are.
And yeah, many of them are more talented than I am. Okay, I'll be the first to admit that I'm not the best, but I was the first or one of the first to go out there and really, really push it and share and comment and let people know, hey, I'm here. And
yeah,
you know, I'm just like, I'm sure there's something that you have a claim to fame for you or your show that you're
yeah,
probably not the only guy who does it, but people refer to you that
no,
way because.
No,
but,
no I'm not the
yeah,
only guy
I'm
who does
not, yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not the only blind blogger. And there, like I said, there are many of them who are much better at this than I am. And
yeah, yeah.
Sometimes I'm actually a little bit chagrined about being called the blind blogger and having the website when I know that there are other cats out there who are better at it than I am. So,
you know, but I think you hit on something there. You're the blind blogger. I think that's the only title out there. I don't think anyone else has that. You know, so that makes you unique in that because I think I've had blind people on this show. They were authors like you. They were entrepreneurs, and they were just some of the smartest and the most brightest and the most talented people out there. And, you know, I have heard, I don't know if it's true, and you can elaborate on this if you want. I have heard when someone loses their sight, you know, they develop another talent because of losing that sight.
Well, I'm not 100% sold on that idea. I do believe that that as big a part of your life as your vision is, when you lose your vision, it's going to change you. And you know, some people that's going to make them better listeners. Some people
yeah,
it's going to
yeah,
give them a better ear and make them a better musician. Some people, it's going to give them a story that they can share that they wouldn't have had without it. And some people are going to put more of their time into their education or into training because of the loss of the vision. You know, one of the things I can think of in my own life is I generally had to work harder in school, but even if I had to, I would have because it was the one place where the vision problem didn't keep me from enjoying what I was doing and participating along with other people. So it could be that the vision loss just allows you to focus more on other things. I have a good friend,
yeah,
Rob. I can't think of his name. He's got a he's a real estate agent and a coach, and he was telling me that he thinks that one of the big advantages I have in life is that I'm not distracted by all the visual garbage out there that will, you know, cause you to think things about yourself or what you're doing that would distract you or, you know, maybe even discourage you. He says, you know, you don't have all those distractions. And I'm like, you know, he's probably right to a point. So that may have something to do with it too. But I know my hearing is better, but I know my sense of smell is nowhere near as good as people have been portrayed in the movies. And
yeah,
my doctor.
Oh, so this is a movie thing. It's a movie thing, kinda. Max,
yeah.
Max, I see here that you've lost over 200 pounds through a combination of gastric surgery, diet, exercise, positive attitude, and meditation and prayer. How was that?
It was a long process. It took over 2 years from the first weigh-in to the point where I was at what my doctor considers my ideal weight of 260 pounds. My first weigh-in was on Valentine's Day of 2012 at 512 pounds. And my brother has a picture of me where I look like I weighed at least 600, but, you know, you can only go by the scale. The scale said 512 when I weighed in. 6 months later, when I had the surgery, I had lost 80 pounds. And by the time, you know, a year and a half, 2 years after the surgery, I had gotten to where, you know, I'm at 256, 250, 260. And, you know, as my friends like to joke with me, Max, you lost a whole person. So, and a lot of it was, I'll be honest with you, a lot of it was learning things that you learn growing up thinking they were good for you, and then you find out as an adult that those aren't very good for you, you know. So
yeah, yeah.
a lot of it was learning new habits, and one of the biggest things that they taught me that made a big change in my life, even though I still had the surgery, was to swap liquids for solid, because a lot of people just don't realize how many calories they're taking in their coffee, Coke, milk, juice, you know, soup broth, anything liquid, because your body can handle so much more liquid than solid. So you can make a big difference in your calories if you just switch, like, milk for low-fat cheese, cottage cheese, yogurt, things like that. That made a big difference in my life. But yeah, a lot of it was learning new habits. And one of the big things they told us during this process is, you know, you can't do it all overnight. You're going to have to make a bunch of changes, but don't get scared. Don't overwhelm yourself. Don't go thinking there's no way I can do all of this stuff. Just pick one thing, do that one thing for a month. If you feel like you've got it under control, then at the end of the month, pick another thing and add to it. And
that's a good idea. Here I am
4 years later, and I'm able to maintain my weight. I can go to a family dinner. I can go to a party. I can get to the holiday seasons on the calendar and not cringe and go, you know, will I be 10 pounds or 20 pounds or 30 pounds heavier when January gets here, kind of thing, like I used to.
Congratulations, man. That was a great feat. A lot of people can't do that because of the weaknesses. A lot of people are just weak for food. And one of the things I know about food can kill you if you do not portion it out at some times. And also food can remedy any illness that you've gotten. You know, I understand that with heart disease, you can eat food to cure heart disease. I didn't know that. I just found that out. I thought heart disease was like something that was incurable. Diabetes, I mean, you can reverse that. However, you can reverse your diabetes, but if you start doing the same thing, it's going to come back. And so a lot of these illnesses that are caused by food, they can be remedied by food also in moderation.
Right. That's why I chose the title I did for my second book. It's not the cookie, it's the bag. In most people's cases, it's not the food, it's the quantity, the timing, and the reason behind why they're eating. You know, should mention, I did have gastric surgery. I had a procedure called the duodenal switch, which is it's one of the newer ones. But the thing people should remember is that when you have a surgery, less than 50% of the people who have a surgery will lose 80 to 90% of the weight that they need to lose. So the surgery is not a guarantee. It's not a quick fix. I can eat whatever I want to because the surgery will keep me from eating too much. You know, to a certain extent, the surgery will help you, but without changing your diet, finding some exercise that you can repeat. You know, without changing how you do things, it won't work for you long term, like any better than any other form of diet and exercise.
Right.
So.
That's great, Max. That's wonderful. Max, can you tell us something about your book?
Well, I've got two books so far. Mm-hmm. The first one is called Leading You Out of the Darkness into the Light, A Blind Man's Inspirational Guide to Success. And it shares some of my life experiences along the way to getting to this point. It has 11 exercises that people can work through. It has my answers to the exercises. And it has my email address so they can report on their progress by email as they're working through the exercises in the book. And
wow.
My second book was, people told me not to do that. They said, Max, if you put your email address in the book, you're going to get a lot of people emailing you and taking up a bunch of your time. I was like, you know, I didn't write the book to get rich. I didn't write it to become famous.
Yeah.
I wrote it to help people. So I'll put it in there and we'll see what happens. And so far, I haven't been overwhelmed with emails from it, and most people have been very respectful, and I've even had more than a few who have said, you know, if I start to take too much of your time, let me know, and, you know, we can look at my hiring you on a one-to-one basis. So I've been It hasn't been as bad as people thought it was going to. But the main thing is, me and you both know a lot of people who have read the book, listened to the audio, went to the seminar, and the next day they were still at the same spot they were stuck in. So I figured the least I could do is show people I want them to succeed and let them know there's at least one person that will listen to them and will give them a positive ear. And, you know, that's staying true to who you are. So I did that. I'm sorry, go ahead.
One of the things I do know, I mean, you may think that you're not getting a hell of a lot of responses from your book, but you have to understand, people are reading your book. They are downloading it. They are getting a lot of information from it. Some people will not contact you and let you know that. Some people may not even leave a review, but that's the way some people are. But, you know, if they like your book, a lot of people aren't going. For me, for instance, if I buy a book, I may not contact the author and say, "Author, I bought a book." You know, that's the way people are. But that doesn't mean that your book is not being read, you know. And tell us where people can go find your book.
Okay, they can find my book at theblindblogger.net, or they can go to amazon.com/author/Maxwell Ivey, and Ivy is spelled V-I-V-E-Y. And just a quick mention of the second book, It's Not the Cookie, It's the Bag, an easy-to-follow guide to weight loss success. And in there I share the stuff that I've learned and that I do in order to lose the weight and maintain my weight where I'm at a healthy place now. So I think it's a good book. And I appreciate you giving me some encouragement there about the first book, because you are right. People aren't always going to contact you or share with
exactly.
you. Exactly. But I get enough comments through my blog and enough people who contact me other ways to know that, it is helping people, and it was a good book. And, you know, I wrote the book as much for my education and my story as I did for anybody else's, because it was one of those things. Once I started it, I don't know about everybody else, but to me, the first book was about publishing the book. It was about seeing if I could do it, you know, and
you did it.
Finished, published and on Amazon, and having people buy copies and having it help some people. That made the book a success, so I'm cool with it. It was a great experience, and I'm looking forward to my next book. I got lots of titles running around in my head. I'm trying to pick a good one. So,
yeah, writing is addictive. I'm a writer myself, man, and I know it's addictive. And you know what? I can't really do writing if it's not fun. I make everything, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, I try to make it fun. Because if it's fun, if I'm writing, sitting at my computer, composing is writing, and I'm laughing and I'm grinning and I'm having a great time and excited, that's when I know that it's going to be good. And that's when I know that other people, when they do read the book, they will enjoy it as much as I enjoyed writing it.
I couldn't agree with you more. I got little tingles going up and down my back when you were talking just then. Because I'll tell you what I have found out about writing. Not only is it addictive, but I have found that I've looked up and noticed myself writing on something and going, "Max, you've got real work you're supposed to be doing. You know, you've got people want you to list their equipment. You know, there's stuff you're supposed to be doing that's on your to-do list, and you're writing. So, you know, instead of watching TV or watching a movie or playing a trivia track on my phone, I'm noticing that my number one diversion now has become writing. And it's crazy how that happened.
Mm-hmm. Are you also a reader?
Oh yeah, I read 40-50 books a year. I split between fiction and nonfiction. I read a lot while I'm riding my bike and walking on my treadmill.
Wow.
And I like to say this. This is one thing I want people to know. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Your mind doesn't always need a self-help book. Sometimes your mind needs Stephanie Lawrence or Judith Kranz or Steve Patterson or Patricia Cornwell just as much as it needs Joyce Meyer or Joel Osteen or Eric Weinberger. You know, and just like the body, sometimes the body is just calling for you to go find it a Snickers. Sometimes your mind is just calling for you to find a book that will distract you, let your mind roam. Mm-hmm. There was one year in 2001 where I was traveling a lot, but I had a lot of books on tape with me. I read 157 books that year.
Wow. Wow.
I know. It's like, even now, I think
that's great.
You know, but I tell people, you know, if you read while you're exercising and you exercise 30 minutes a day, you can read a book about every other week or so. And so that gets you to 2 a month. That gets you to about 20 a year. And I honestly believe writers have to read, because the more you read, not only
totally.
You know, it helps you. Not only helps you with your ideas and your creativity, but it helps you learn the craft, learn the style, learn the rules and the rhythm of good work.
I agree. I totally agree. Maxwell, we're just about out of time, and I want to ask you, would you like a link to this show? Maybe you can put it on your website or your blog. People can come by
your website or your blog and listen to you on this show. Yeah, I would love that. I'd also like to download the episode and put it in my vault. I'm working on a project where I'm going to take a lot of my past radio interviews and put them in a compilation along with a print transcript and some comments from the people I was on the shows with. So I may be contacting you in the future to see if you'll write a short bit about my being on your show. So
no problem. No problem.
All righty. Because one of the things I have become, it's I've become the expert on getting on shows. So I figure, what the heck, I'll turn my shows into a book. And, you know, people are actually coming to me wanting to know, hey, Max, how do you get on them shows? Can you help me get on them shows? And I'm like, I'm actually offering a service. People are actually hiring me to do all of that grunt work that it takes to get them on shows, you know, because you got to send a lot of pitch emails. You got to do a lot of searching on the internet, reading through email lists. And, you know, it doesn't just happen as easily as people think. And when I tell them exactly how hard I work to line up all these shows, they're like, I don't want to do that. So, yeah, I'm actually getting hired to help people promote their books, albums, and movies on radio shows
That's great. All right, Maxwell Ivey on the George Wilder Jr. Show. I will be in touch with you in a few hours, and we will get you that link. Maxwell, thanks for being on the show.
It's just Max, George. Me and you are friends now, as far as I'm concerned. Thanks for having me on. Sublimeblogger.net. If you don't find what you need there, use the contact form. I really love being here. You have a blessed evening, George.
You too. Bye-bye. All right, that was Matthew Ivey on the Maxwell. I'm keep saying Matthew. What's wrong with me? Maxwell. It's right in front of me. Ivey on the George Wilder Jr. Show. I will be right back, folks. Stay with me. Okay. Gladys didn't break up weak Wi-Fi.
You are now listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Block Talk Radio.
Well, once again, I want to thank my magnificent guest, Maxwell Ivey. I told you folks I have some wonderful people on the show, knowledgeable people. They're here to help out in any way that they can, you know, with their own personal experiences. They use their own personal experiences to help other people, and that's a great thing, and that's what this show is all about. Once again, I want to say this show is about making the world a better place, one show at a time, if possible. It is so effed up. I mean, it's going to take a miracle, but if we hang in there, we can do it. The world is so effed up, it's a shame. It is so messed up, and I don't know, folks. Anyway, I want to thank my guest. I mean, he's blind. I think this is the second or third guest that I've had on the show who was totally blind, but was out there using their illness or their disability or their talent and talent to help others, to help those who are sighted, you know. And so that's a great thing. I like that kind of thing. I love that when you're out, come on the George Wilder Jr. Show and to offer and to help others by telling them your story. And that's a great thing. That's wonderful. All right, it's summertime, folks, and it's about time. I mean, I think that yesterday was the first day of summer, June 20th. Today is June 21st. If you podcast the show, download the show for later, you'll know that this is a June 21st, and it's a summer day in Chicago. The tornadoes haven't gotten here yet, folks. I mean, this is what the national news is saying about Chicago. I don't want to wish tornadoes on anybody, especially on Chicago, because this is where I'm from. And it's just a beautiful day, a beautiful time, and it's all good, folks. It's all good. Okay, let's move right along. Let's move right along. We're talking about the election, folks, because that's one of the most important things that is coming up in a few months, the election of our lives. And they're saying that Donald Trump is running out of campaign funds. They don't want to give him money or something to that effect, you know, I mean. But I'm pretty sure Donald Trump will find some way of becoming president of the United States. It just won't be in America. All right, Rahm is scared of teachers. That is what Governor Bruce Rauner thinks, that Bruce Rauner is going around in the media. I know I'm harping on Bruce Rauner again because he's trying to take Illinois away from the people and give it to his people. And he's not going to do that, folks. And I'm on the radio. I'm going to be boisterous as I possibly can. He's going around the state saying that Rahm Emanuel is afraid of the teachers' union in Illinois. Now, Rahm Emanuel is not afraid of the teachers' union in Illinois. But this is what Rauner is lying about. He wants the people of Chicago to think that their mayor is a coward and a liberal, you know, ineffective. The only person that's ineffective is Bruce Rauner. He's been ineffective since the day he walked into the governor's mansion. He's been ineffective, and now he's saying is Bruce Rauner, because like I've said, Bruce Rauner has tons of spending bills on his desk that he will not sign. And even if he did sign these spending bills, folks, some of the programs, some of the jobs are permanently lost because of him. And then he is running for re-election. He wants people to vote him back into office. He's crazy. Where is he from? Karen Lewis called him a sociopath. Forrest Claypool called him ignorant. His poll numbers are at 34%. Nobody likes him. How in the hell is he going to get elected? People are going to be running against him in droves. I mean, he's given so much. Let's say if he's going to run again in 2018, he should rethink that, because he's already given so much ammunition to work with. And the main issue that they're going to be hitting him over the head with is not having a budget enough for him to lose in a double landslide. How in the hell is he going to run for re-election when he hasn't even done his job, and expect for people to go out there and vote for you when you have not done your job? You have pissed on the Constitution. You have pissed on the Constitution. And you expect for people to voting blues and push Bruce Rauner? You've got to be crazy. That's probably what it is. It's probably mental. He has to realize nobody, they don't even want him on the south and west sides of the city, because he's decimated those communities so badly with all of these funding and budget cuts. He tries to visit over there, they run him away from over there. Of course he's going to, you know, spin and lie about the whole thing, but basically they ran him away from over there. Would you want somebody coming in your community who has destroyed it and then say, hey, wow, vote for me? No, you would not. This is what Bruce Rauner expects. You can't expect to go in these areas where you've decimated, destroyed, and then go and say, vote for me in November. Because that's all he's doing. He's campaigning. His election is 2 years away, and yet he is in campaign mode. I think the only reason why Bruce Rauner is in campaign mode is because he knows that the Democrats have three or four people who are thinking about opposing him November 2018. And he wants to, when Bruce Rauner was running, he said he was going to do one term and that was it. I guess he just likes the feel of having power in his hands. You know, wow. And I want to say to people, get out there and vote in November. This is the reason why we have so many Republicans in some of these southern states in America, down south. We have so many of these Republicans in Mississippi, all down states. The reason why they are there is because people did not vote. People did not get their butts out and vote, or people voted against their own interests. But I think the main issue is that people did not vote. And when you don't vote, you get a Republican. I've said this before, do not ever think because you do not vote that your vote will not count. It will count. Your vote will go against you. If you do not vote, the vote will go against you, and you will get a rogue-ass Republican in office. That's what's happened in Illinois. That's what's been happening all around the state. Shocked when I first heard that there was a Republican governor in Mississippi. Obviously, those folks didn't get up off their asses and go vote. And the stupid ass things on the people of their states, like welfare people on welfare or food stamps having to take drug tests. It's dumb. It's really dumb. If you don't want them on welfare, if you don't want them on food stamps, then do not give it to them, but do not humiliate people like that. You don't humiliate
You are now listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Block Talk Radio.
Yeah, it's going to be a fun election year, folks. We just have to get out there and vote the right way. Actually, voting the right way means voting against anybody who doesn't hold your interest. You know, we cannot have Donald Trump in the White House. We know that. That cannot happen. But then there's a lot of people who still don't like Clinton. I'm not crazy about her, but, you know, I would rather have her than Donald Trump. Also, a lot of Republicans would rather have her, Hillary Clinton, in the White House instead of Donald Trump. And now we have to try to get Bernie Sanders to drop all the way out and try to have his supporters give their support to Clinton. You know, but it seems like Donald Trump is like he's just imploding, and there's no doubt about it. I think come November 2016, I think Hillary is going to just wipe him out in the election. All right, you're listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio. We will be right back, folks. Stay with me. The George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air. We got fires in California. We got, I think they're saying there's 8 wildfires out west in California. That's one of the reasons why I never moved to California. I think California is probably one of the most beautiful states in America, but with all these wildfires and earthquakes, I mean, you actually can't escape escape these kind of things. And north and east, you have tornadoes, you have twisters. We're just on earth living in borrowed time, folks. That's all it is, borrowed times. And I hope like hell that a lot of people in California and on the western end over there, they're stay safe, firefighters and everybody else who are fighting fires. And for those who have lost homes or who will lose homes, homes, their homes, in this horrific incident that keeps on happening all the time, especially when the weather gets very, very hot. The fires, you know, it seems like we just have fires, and the, you know, it's just a mess, you know. And I, my heart goes out to those folks who have to suffer through all of that smoke and whatever that's going on over there. And my heart goes out to those Californians. Stay safe, everybody. Stay safe. All right, you're listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio. Let's see. We will have Dr. I think Kelly Baez on the show. She will be talking about diabetes. I believe that that's going to be happening in July. So we got a little clip on diabetes to try to get you ready for that. So let's see. Here we go. Diabetes. Because sooner or later, it's going to happen to everybody.
I have the best job in the world.
Okay.
I'm a doctor. No, believe me. That's not why. I'm an obesity doctor. I have the honor of working with a group of people subject to the last widely accepted prejudice, being fat. These people have suffered a lot by the time they see me. Shame, guilt, blame, and outright discrimination. The attitude that many take, including those in healthcare, is that these people are to blame for their situation. If they could just control themselves, they wouldn't be overweight, and they're not motivated to change. Please let me tell you, this is not the case. The blame, if we've got to extend some here, has been with our advice, and it's time we change that. Obesity is a disease. It's not something created by lack of character. It's a hormonal disease, and there are many hormones involved, and one of the main ones is a hormone called insulin. Most obese individuals are resistant to this hormone, insulin. So what does that mean exactly, to be resistant to insulin? Well, insulin resistance is essentially a state of type 2 diabetes. Insulin's job is to drive glucose or blood sugar into the cells where it can be used. In a nutshell, when someone is insulin resistant, they're having trouble getting blood sugar where it needs to go, into those cells. And it just can't hang out in the blood after we eat, or we would all have a diabetic crisis after every meal. So when someone is resistant to insulin, the body's response to this is to just make more of it. And insulin levels will rise and rise. And for a while, years even, this is going to keep up and blood sugar levels can remain normal. However, usually it can't keep up forever. And even at those elevated levels of insulin are not enough to keep blood sugar in the normal range. So it starts to rise. That's diabetes. It probably won't surprise you to hear that most of my patients have insulin resistance or diabetes. And if you're sitting there thinking, that's not me, you actually might want to think again. Because almost 50% of adult Americans now have diabetes or prediabetes. That is almost 120 million of us. But that's hardly everyone who has issues with insulin. Because as I was saying, people have elevated insulin levels due to insulin resistance for years, even decades before the diagnosis of even prediabetes is made. Plus, it's been shown that 16 to 25% of normal weight adults are also insulin resistant. So in case you're keeping track, this is a heck of a lot of us. So the trouble with insulin resistance is if it goes up, we are at great risk for developing type 2 diabetes. But also, insulin makes us hungry, and the food we eat much more likely to be stored as fat. Insulin is our fat storage hormone. So we can start to see how it's going to be a problem for diseases like obesity and metabolic issues like diabetes. But what if we trace this problem back to the beginning and we just didn't have so much glucose around that insulin needed to deal with? Let's take a look at how that could be. Everything you eat is either a carbohydrate, a protein, or a fat. and they all have a very different effect on glucose and therefore insulin levels, as you can see on the graph. So when we eat carbohydrates, our insulin and glucose are going to spike up fast. And with proteins, it looks a lot better. But take a look at what happens when we eat fat. Essentially nothing. A flat line. And this is going to wind up being very important. So now I want to translate that graph for you into a real-world situation. I want you to go back and think about the last time you ate an American version of Chinese food. We all know there's rules associated with this, right? And the first rule is you're going to overeat because the stop signal doesn't get sent until you are literally busting at the seams. Rule number two is in an hour, you're starving. Why? Well, because the rice in that meal caused glucose and insulin to skyrocket, which triggered hunger, fat storage, and cravings. So, if you're insulin resistant to begin with, and your insulin levels are already higher, you really are hungrier all the time. And we have this set up. Eat carbs, your glucose goes up, your insulin goes up, and you have hunger and fat storage. So, how do we recommend to these people to eat? Because it seems like that would be really important, and it is. Let's focus just on type 2 diabetes, because the general recommendations are to tell patients with type 2 diabetes to consume 40 to 65 grams of carbohydrates per meal, plus more at snacks. Trust me on this, that's a lot of carbs. And remember what's going to happen to glucose and insulin, blood sugar and insulin, when we eat them? Yes. We are essentially recommending that they eat exactly what's causing their problem. Sound crazy? It really, really is. Because at its root, diabetes is a state of carbohydrate toxicity. We can't get the blood sugar into the cells, and that causes a problem in the short term, but the long-term consequences are even greater. And insulin resistance is essentially a state of carbohydrate intolerance. So why, oh why, do we want to continue to recommend to people to eat them? The American Diabetes Association guidelines specifically state that there is inconclusive evidence to recommend a specific carbohydrate limit. But those guidelines go right on to say what we all know. Carbohydrate intake is the single biggest factor in blood sugar levels and therefore need for medication. These guidelines then go on to say, hey, look, if you're taking certain diabetic medications, you actually have to eat carbs. Otherwise, your blood sugar can go too low. Okay, so let's take a look at the vicious cycle that advice just set up. So it's eat carbs, so you have to take medicine. Then you have to eat more carbs so you avoid the side effect of those medications. And around we go. Even worse is that nowhere in the ADA guidelines is the goal of reversing type 2 diabetes. This needs to be changed because type 2 diabetes can be reversed in many, if not most, situations, especially if we start early. Not only do we need to let people know this, but we have to start giving them the practical advice so they can do this. Consider carbs. First, here's a shocker for you. We don't need them. Seriously. Our minimum daily requirement for carbohydrates is zero. We have essential amino acids. Those are proteins. Essential fatty acids, but nope, no essential carb. A nutrient is essential if we have to have it to function, and we can't make it from something else. We make glucose, plenty of it, all the time. It's called gluconeogenesis. So, we don't need them. The overconsumption of them is making us very sick, yet we are continuing to recommend to patients to consume close to, if not more, than half of their total energy intake every day from them. It doesn't make sense. Let's talk about what does. Cutting carbs a lot. Yes, in my clinic, we teach patients to eat with carbs as the minority of their intake, not the majority. So how does that work? Well, when our patients decrease their carbs, their glucose goes down, and they don't need as much insulin. So those insulin levels drop and fast. And this is very important because a study looking at our National Health and Nutrition Examination survey data, better known as NHANES, showed that the single biggest risk factor for coronary artery disease is insulin resistance. It is responsible for a whopping 42% of heart attacks. Low-carb intervention works so fast that we can literally pull people off of hundreds of units of insulin in days to weeks. One of my favorite stories is a very recent one. A young gal, but who had an almost 20-year history of type 2 diabetes, came in when a physician from another clinic told her she was just sick and should probably get used to it. Her diabetes was way out of control. This despite the fact that she was on multiple medications, including almost 300 units of insulin that was being injected into her continuously every day via a pump. All of this, remember, blood sugar still out of control. So we put her on a low-carb diet, and now let's fast forward 4 months. She lost weight, yes, but better than that. Sick no more. Her blood sugar levels were now normal all of the time. This on, get this, no diabetes medication. Gone was 300 units of insulin, no more insulin pump, no more pricking her finger multiple times each day. Gone, all of it, no more diabetes. One of the greatest joys of my job is to be able to tell a patient like this that they no longer have diabetes. And we ceremoniously take it off their problem list together. So, are they cured? Is this a miracle? We'll leave that grandstanding to Dr. Oz. Cured would imply that it can't come back. And if they start eating excessive carbs again, it will. So no, not cured. But they don't have diabetes any longer. It's resolved. And it can stay that way as long as we keep away the cause. So what does this look like then? How does somebody eat this way? Well, first let me tell you what it's not. Low carb is not zero carb, and it is not high protein. These are common criticisms that are so frustrating because they're not true. Next, if we take the carbs out, what are we going to put in? Because remember, there's only three macronutrients. If one goes down, one has to go up. My patients eat fat and a lot of it. What you say? I mean, what's going to happen when you eat fat? Well, let me tell you, you're going to be happy because fat tastes great and it is incredibly satisfying. But remember, fat is the only macronutrient that's going to keep our glucose, blood sugar, and insulin levels low, and that is so important. So I want you to now hear my simple rules for eating. These rules, you have to remember, are even going to be more important if you are one of the tens of millions of Americans who have trouble with insulin levels. Rule number one, if it says light, low fat, or fat-free, stays in the grocery store, because if they took the fat out, they put carbs and chemicals in. Rule number two, eat food. The most important rule in low-carb nutrition. Real food does not come in a box, and no one should have to tell you real food is natural. You should know that when you look at it. Don't eat anything you don't like. And eat when you're hungry. Don't eat when you're not, no matter what the clock says. And number five is a simple way to remember what we want to avoid. No GPS. No grains, no potatoes, and no sugar. That last one is a biggie, right? No grains? Yeah, no grains. But we have to have them. Nope, they're a carb. But whole grains are so good for us. Well, first of all, there are actually very few foods out there that are truly whole grain, even when they say they are. Most foods that purport themselves to be whole grain are highly processed and the fiber benefit ruined. Or they're coming with highly refined flour. Usually both of these things. So if you are one of the truly insulin-sensitive people, you can eat real whole grain. But if you are in the enormous slice of our population with insulin issues, it's making things worse. So what if you are one of the real insulin-sensitive people? Can you still eat this way? Yes. I'm a great example. Over a year ago, I decided I would cut my carbs as low as I recommend to my diabetic patients. Now, it's not mandatory for my health like it is for theirs. I'm not insulin resistant, so would this be a problem? No, that's just the thing. Unless you have an exceedingly rare syndrome, then cutting carbs is going to be good for you, even if it's not necessary. I want to show you a couple pictures of my radical food. So this is a common breakfast in my house. So does it look like I just broke my own rule? I didn't, because this muffin is made with coconut flour. I bake all the time still. I just use non-grain-based flours. Coconut, almond, hazelnut, flax, they make delicious things. And this is a typical dinner in my house with a typical starch. That would be the sautéed mushrooms. No, my patients and I eat delightful food all of the time and enjoy it. But what about the research on this? I mean, is this just anecdotal evidence now from my clinic? No. There are dozens of randomized control trials looking at low-carb intervention for things like diabetes, cardiovascular risk factors, obesity. They're consistent. It works. There are even a large number of studies showing that low-carb nutrition decreases inflammatory markers, which is making it really exciting for diseases like cancer. We just finished a study in our clinic, and what we did is we took 50 type 2 diabetic patients that were treated with our low-carb, high-fat-based program, and we compared them to 50 patients who were treated with the ADA guidelines. And after 6 months, not only did we find a significant metabolic advantage for the low-carb group, but, and let's face it, this is important, a huge cost savings. Our analysis showed that our patients could save over $2,000 a year just on the diabetes meds they were no longer taking. Just think how fast that adds up in our diabetes epidemic now that we are spending $250 billion a year on in this country. So I want to show you a slide now that demonstrates where that savings is coming from. So this is looking just at the insulin difference in the two groups after 6 months. And what we can see is that the low-carb group was able to decrease their insulin by almost 500 units a day, whereas in the ADA-treated group, they had to increase their insulin by almost 350 units a day. Two important things. Number one, insulin's expensive. And number two, not all the people in this study were even on insulin, which makes these results even more impressive. But what I would say is that this graph really represents two different approaches to treating this disease. The first, our group with the goal of reversing disease, meaning they need less medicine. And the second group, which very clearly aligns with the ADA guidelines, which states that diabetes is a progressive disease requiring more medicine over time. Progressive, unless we take away the cause. What's the problem then? Why is this not everywhere? Why isn't low-carb the norm? There's two big reasons. Number one, status quo. It is hard to break. There are many agendas involved. We got this notion that low-fat was the way to go decades ago, but a recent study just came out showing that there was zero randomized control evidence to recommend to Americans to remove the fat from our diet, and that's how the carbs got added in. It was essentially a huge experiment on millions of people, and it failed miserably. The second reason we don't see it everywhere is money. Don't be fooled. There's a lot of money to be made.
You are now listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Block Talk Radio.
There's a lot of money to be made keeping you sick. That's what she was going to say. And I've stated this on yesterday's show that there is a lot of money in keeping you sick. The medical industry is about money. It's about profit. So if they keep you on all these damn medications that you don't need, you know, it's money. A majority of these medications you don't need. I mean, a majority of these medications will kill you faster than the disease will that you have. It'll kill you faster. You know, so diabetes is reversible. There's no doubt about it. Heart disease, reversible. You don't have to get a stroke. You don't have to get a heart attack. None of these things have to happen. You know, everything is reversible. Food is the cause of just about every ailment you have. And food can be the remedy. Food can be your medicine. Food makes you sick. Food can make you well. You just have to know how to do it. take your doctor's advice as long as this is sound advice coming from your doctor. And I've said this before. Always get a second opinion, second or third opinion. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. All right, you've been listening to the George Walter Jr. Show. It's 7:22 straight up. Chicago time, 7:22 p.m. that is. It's getting a little bit cloudy, but it's still nice outside, folks. I just love my studio here. We're going to fix it up and make it a little bit more presentable for me because I'm the one doing the show. I'm the host. I'm the talk show host. And it's just a beautiful day outside. I see no tornadoes yet, but they said that they're coming. So maybe later on tonight when it's, you know, when it's pretty dark. And we'll see what happens there. I'm in my studio. We're near the lake. It's a great time. It's the second day of summer, 2016, and it is just wonderful, folks. It's wonderful. And I'm just learning that the public schools in Chicago, they're out for the summer. You know, I thought that they were going to – I thought it was going to be either yesterday – either tomorrow or the next day, but it's sooner than I thought. They are out today. And I'm also learning that a lot of teachers have quit. They've quit. They've gone. I mean, a lot of principals have left the Chicago public school system because of the budget crisis, the budget impasse. And I want to say again, these guys in Springfield, the politicians, they're not talking. They're nowhere to. Nobody's talking. There's no votes. There's nothing. Nobody's working. Wow. Why are they getting paid? The Illinois Constitution said there must be a budget in place every single year. They are defying the Constitution. Somebody should go to jail. Yeah, teachers are quitting. Principals are quitting. Our colleges and universities, the enrollments are down. The people aren't selecting Illinois universities anymore because they're having money problems. It's bad. It's bad. If you have a kid who wants to go to college after high school, more than likely he will not pick a school in Illinois, no college, not a university, because these institutions are having funding problems because of the state impasse of not passing a budget a second time in a row for the second cycle. This is crazy. I would leave too. I mean, if I was a teacher, I would leave myself. I don't blame them because teachers, most of these teachers are young. They're bright. They're smart. They can take their talents elsewhere. And that's what they're doing. That is what they're doing. It used to be 3 million people in the city of Chicago. Now it's down to 2 million and something. Chicago will become the fourth largest city because we're losing population because of these rotten politicians who will not admit that they're screwing up the state, but we know they are. All right, you've been listening to the George Walter Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio. It's just awful, folks. In the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois, we need divine intervention. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Donald Trump playing Donald Trump. It's like he's doing this role, but there's something behind the role. And that is hard.